Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Rodriguez, a PhD candidate in history at Vanderbilt University. Today, I'll talk to Brendan Goff, an assistant professor of history at the New College of Florida, about his book, Rotary International and the Selling of American Capitalism, which was just published by Harvard University Press. Goff's monograph traces the history of Rotary International from its origins in Chicago in 1905 to its rapid growth during the first four decades of the 20th century. In doing so, Goff places U.S. power at the center of his analysis. He argues that Rotary International was able to succeed where Wilsonian internationalism wasn't, by strategically distancing itself from the state. Rotarians advanced their own civic internationalism that emphasized the organization's nonprofit status, identity as a non-governmental organization, and commitment to the community-minded principle of service above self. This version of internationalism and the rhetoric that supported it allowed Rotary International to deflect criticisms of mere boosterism or intervention by other means. Goff's nuanced and critical analysis of Rotary International's history provides a new way of thinking about the role of Midwestern cities in the expansion of U.S. capital and consumer culture abroad, the many inflections of interwar internationalism, and the use of racialized power in creating and structuring connections between business people in the United States and the rest of the world. Welcome to the show, Brendan.
Thank you, Stephen. Very happy to be here.
I want to start with a question about how you came to this project.
In two sentences or less? I guess in some sense, every dissertation and book project is autobiographical in one form, to some degree or another, one form or another. That certainly was the case with me. I mentioned this in the acknowledgments that I never heard of Rotary Clubs or Rotary International, like a lot of people, I suppose, until a friend of a friend in Pittsburgh back in the early 90s said, hey, you should look into their ambassadorial scholarships. I understand you want to go abroad and et cetera. And I thought, okay. And so I looked into it and applied, and I didn't think I had a whole lot of chance at that, but lo and behold, I was able to get a one-year scholarship through Rotary's ambassadorial scholarship program to the University of Glasgow, where I studied for a year, and I did an MPhil in philosophy. And it was a transformative experience in a lot of ways. I mean, I was just kind of a simple, kind of basically working-class kid from Pittsburgh who got to go abroad. But I think what really happened is that several years later, I went, and you and I talked about this already a little bit, but I decided to go abroad again, kind of on my own. And so in the late 90s, 96 to 99, I was in Spain teaching English as a second language to a lot of Spaniards and actually to a lot of Europeans and Latin Americans, et cetera, who happened to be in Madrid, a very cosmopolitan city. And I realized as I was teaching all these classes, the constant sense of like, of a lot of my students, you know, there's this thing called the United States of America, and I think I know what it's all about, but at the same time, I don't think I know what it's all about, you know? And so they'll sit there and quote chapter and verse from their favorite music or film or something. So it was like, it was as if they were all, you know, engaging whether they liked it or not with the United States in all these many layered ways. And then I realized as I was teaching these classes that, you know, what's going on here? What is this? And I didn't have a language for it. And so that kind of drove my desire to go for a PhD in history and also to study 20th century history and U.S. history in the way that I ended up studying it at Michigan, which was very interdisciplinary and emphasizing, you know, the history of capitalism, or what became known as the history of capitalism, from a transnational perspective, from a non-state perspective, and whenever possible, from a non-U.S. perspective as well. So the book kind of, in the dissertation project, emerged from that, the personal trajectory going into over the course of the 90s, and then the intellectual journey, especially while a grad student at the University of Michigan. So, you know, the book is kind of an expression of all of those multiple, you know, layers at once.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. I mean, that's really fascinating. It certainly comes across, I think, in the book is, you know, coming at this topic from so many different angles. And I think perhaps that's reflected from the personal experience. A lot of listeners are probably familiar in some way with Rotary, the kind of familiar logo of Rotary when you're driving into many U.S. Towns. But, you know, your book is looking at the growth of Rotary in its first 40 years of its history. Can you begin by giving us a bit of an overview of what that growth looked like from its founding in Chicago to where you end the book? I know that's asking a lot, but it's just kind of a bird's eye view. And then we could talk a little bit about some of the case studies and what those kind of tell us about the growth of U.S. power and some of the other topics that you touch on.
Sure. I mean, I'll have to kind of paint in broad brush strokes, obviously. But in some ways, you know, yes, the original Rotary Club emerges out of Chicago in 1905, which is, for anyone who knows the history of Chicago and the Midwest during that period, you know, Chicago is this massive hustling and bustling industrial behemoth in rapid growth. It's also at the height of what turns out to be the height of the Progressive Era during this period. So it has this kind of, it's a mix of the businessmen's progressivism of the period, an emphasis on that, businessmen's, but also this, and I try to draw this out in the earliest part of the book, in the first chapter especially, that there's this pressing need, or there's a kind of pressing need realized among many businessmen, especially these emerging salaried managers and professionals, that capitalism as a kind of way of life, and especially U.S.'s version of capitalism, needs kind of rehabilitation in the wake of the Gilded Age, and so in many ways one of the key driving factors in the earliest Rotary clubs, first in Chicago and then later, soon thereafter in San Francisco and elsewhere, a lot of the driving force behind that was the need to kind of justify, civilize, standardize, stabilize, whatever, early 20th century capitalism, particularly in the United States, but then soon around the world. So in many ways, the rapid expansion of the Rotary clubs from Chicago in 1905 to San Francisco in 1908, and then very quickly by 1910 and by 1912 throughout all the major U.S. cities. See, that's one of the things that people don't understand about Rotary. In fact, most Rotarians, is that it doesn't start with small town America. It starts in the biggest cities: Chicago, San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, New York City, etc. And then during the World War I period, then it starts really trickling down to the second, third tier, fourth tier cities, right? So that's one major kind of revelation or key component of the nature of Rotary's growth, is that it's not small. It taps into small town America about 10, 15 years later, and it really taps into kind of the ideological image of small town America, as especially it goes around the world. But it's, you know, the first real wave of growth is within the United States and then Canada and Great Britain among major cities. And then, of course, after 1912, or rather 1914, because of World War I, then the growth pattern for the Rotary starts looking or moving into the Caribbean and Latin America. and then also starting to look more and more across the Pacific during the World War I period. And then by 1918, 1919, the upper echelons of Rotary, they're realizing, hey, you know, we could really be moving into Latin America. I mean, they're not just realizing that kind of at a theoretical level. They're actually putting into operation plans for growth throughout the Caribbean and Latin America and the Trans-Pacific region. Do you see? So by 1919, they realized that these are the centers of opportunity and growth, a lot even more so than small town America, even as they're also moving into these small towns throughout the 1920s. So there are multiple vectors of growth during the 1910s and 1920s, kind of drilling down to the smaller towns at the local level, again, in North America, whatever, the British Isles, but also into the Caribbean, Latin America. And then after 1918, 1919, rapidly throughout much of Europe as well. And then after 1920, 1921 in Tokyo, which is chapter 4 of the book, Tokyo, and then by extension, the Japanese Empire. So there's rapid growth in East Asia through Manila, Shanghai, Yokohama, Tokyo, these key port cities. And then chapter 6 covers the rapid growth of the clubs in much of Asia, Southeast Asia, in Central Asia, and East Asia. Thanks to Jim and Lillian Davidson kind of setting up clubs so that by the time you're looking at the start of the 1930s, you already have Rotary clubs all over the world, from the smallest towns of North America to the largest commercial centers and capital centers in virtually any part of the world, other than, say, obviously the Soviet Union, for example.
Well, thank you. That's a really helpful overview. I want to return to kind of what you were saying at the beginning of that overview about the Rotary's function as kind of rehabilitating capitalism and standardizing it and civilizing it. And this ties into what I was kind of talking about in the introduction, which is one of the core, you know, ideas that you develop in the book, which is civic internationalism. Mm-hmm. Could you first define civic internationalism and talk a little bit about how it related to some of the other dominant internationalisms of the time? How did the Rotary differ in its approach? And how did it use that kind of rhetoric of civic internationalism as part of its process of rapidly growing during the time period you just mentioned and those different vectors?
I had a feeling you were going to ask that. and I was trying to review my introduction because I thought you were going to ask that. And I was like, how did I handle that question? But I mean, fair enough, because it's a question that I probably got at every other conference paper in the past 15 years. Yeah. Excuse me. So in one sense, the emphasis on civic is that it's born out of that kind of, how can we improve the local community / city or town that we're in, right? Mm. So it emerges out of that kind of progressive era vibrancy of urban reforms and improvements, right? But and I kind of go into this a little bit, excuse me, with when looking at the Chicago part of the story, the origin story, so to speak, of the group, of the organization, where you have women in civic affairs in the city of Chicago, and they're kind of driven by the kind of class of progressive era maternalist reforms. And so what's happening is that these businessmen are stepping back and saying, well, wait a minute, what is it that businessmen ought to be doing on behalf of the city and on behalf of the community as well. So there's a kind of borrowed status occurring, which I kind of go into, I think it's in the end of my chapter one, where, the role of women is seen as looking to provide a kind of moral ballast for these reform agendas. But at the same time, they're increasingly becoming, the organization is becoming more and more devoted to keeping it as a men's only organization. It started as such formally, and there's the constant push for having women to join in different parts, different cities, different countries, etc. So that adjective civic is laced heavily with a lot of gendered notions of reformist perspectives and reformist agendas that not just within the city of Chicago, but quite literally anywhere you have a Rotary Club or anywhere you have a business organization that's seeking to improve municipal governance, infrastructure, et cetera, right? So that's why I have the adjective civic. And then the internationalist, and then a key component of that civic also is that notion of the service above self and this kind of almost a kind of civil religion built around this notion of serving the community, serving the profession, serving your neighbors, et cetera. And so the language, especially in the first decades, the 1910s and 1920s, is heavily laced with a kind of quasi-religious or even sometimes overtly Christian kind of language, right? But, you know, it's a period of secularization, and that's reflected over time, but it's also reflected by the complexities of this organization going abroad, right? So, and so you have these reformist agendas that are especially focused on improving the city and the business community, for example, of wherever we're talking about. And then also the gendered aspects of that. And then also the fact that this is happening at the international level. And it's so this notion of service above self and the service, what I call the service ideology, others have called it that as well, that it's a way of talking about international and even transnational cultural exchange, informal diplomacy, et cetera, in a way that is neutral enough in its references. It doesn't, in theory at least, it doesn't put any one nation or empire or even, again, in theory, any one race at the center of civilization per se or uplift per se, even though it's clearly coming out of that progressive era dedication towards uplift and civilization. But do you see it's so civic internationalism was a phrase that just came to my head over time there. I tried looking up the phrase. It's used on rare occasion by other historians, you know, you know, like in reference to the Roman Empire or something like that. But I just use the phrase. I found it to be the best way to capture that kind of local civic impulse, as well as the kind of expansive internationalist movement towards peace, cooperation, stability, engagement, et cetera, which is, I mean, it's a really fascinating story. And so you can imagine how it's similar to, but not the same as missionary societies. It's similar to, but not quite the same as Wilsonianism. In fact, I call it Wilsonianism without the state. It's another way of thinking of it. It's similar to all these other forms of internationalism during the first half of the 20th century. But at the end of the day, it's about businessmen improving and reforming their local cities and their business communities, and then making that a kind of international norm, you know? So it's emphasizing the local in the international and the ideological, and it, what's decentered from all that is the nation state.
That I want to hit on this theme about the state. Right. So you kind of talk about, so there's the kind of rhetorical way in which the Rotary distances itself from the state. It's nonprofit. It is, it's not officially affiliated with the state, but then there's also ways in which the very organizational structure of the Rotary, tends to identify itself with the city rather than kind of national sort of, framing. So could you talk a little bit about the ways in which the Rotary was able to distance itself, both kind of rhetorically and then at the level of the institutional structure and how things were handled within the organization on a kind of day-to-day level?
Yeah, thanks. Great question. So I think I have one section. I want to say chapter two, you know, at the corner of state and market, right? So it's such a large, sprawling organization that in some ways it's a bit like the U.S. government. You know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing at any given time. And so in some ways, local clubs and at the district level, for example, which is usually about 25, 50 clubs, maybe 100 clubs, depending. You might have one set of ways of talking about Rotary in one nation or region at a certain period of time that's, you know, sometimes in almost in direct contrast to other places. It gets tricky. So it's not a consistent strategy of distancing from the state. That's why I call it, it's kind of a strategic distancing, because at times, especially, and I try to draw this out, like by the early 50s or late 40s, early 50s, you know, with the Cold War really settling in within the United States, for example, you know, you're going to see Rotary Club talks that are, you know, focusing on the fact that we have a Cold War that we need to win, right? Mm-hmm. You'll see, and I think I cover this in the Cuba chapter, for example, with the Havana Rotary Club in the 1920s, with these really complex, moments of pageantry for the club, where ambassadors and official diplomats are in attendance, and they'll have these big flag ceremonies, right? Mm. So the nation states are not ignored. It's a form of internationalism, not transnationalism, when it comes to that. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it's kind of reflecting almost the pageantry of, say, the Olympics or something like that, where they love to talk about all these nations in the world, et cetera, and then as if they're not privileging any one nation. And yet when push comes to shove, especially, say, for example, by the mid-1930s on, you know, various forms of nationalisms and fascism and so forth really start forcing clubs and members to make a choice, or it, like in the case of the, you know, Nazi Germany, the clubs are formally banned, or with the Japanese Empire, they're formally, by 1937, they're formally banned in Japan by September of 1940 for obvious reasons. At a certain point, you know, these organizations were seen as a foreign entity on our soil, kind of thing, right? Hmm. So it's always a moving target when it comes to the relationship between the states and the markets. And but I think, and this is why I ended up focusing on the evolution, history and evolution of global capitalism with this book, because that wasn't really my starting point way back when. The common denominator was the evolution of capitalism itself over time, and which was a key driver in seeking to keep a distance from the state. But again, when it came to, you know, seeking money from the Department of Defense and ramping up for World War II, which I kind of cover in the chapter on Wichita, they're definitely looking towards the federal government for a source, you know, for military contracts and so forth. Hmm. When it comes to occupation of Japan after World War II, there's a really, and some of that I couldn't even go into, but I came across in my research where, you know, Douglas MacArthur was already very familiar with Rotary clubs because of the Manila Club, and one of his top aide-de-camps was Carlos Romulo. And so he was looking to reinstate the Rotary clubs in Japan after 1945, because this was a known entity to both MacArthur and a known entity to the Japanese businessmen who had set up these clubs, you know, all over throughout the Japanese Empire between 1920 and 1940. You see, mm-hmm. So suddenly the state is something of interest and of use to Rotary, as well as, from the point of view of the state, Rotary is now of interest to them as well. You see,
right?
So it always depends on the time and the context.
Yeah, I think that this attention to the kind of strategic nature of it, I think, is one of my favorite parts of the book. I mean, when I think of some of the earlier work by historians of U.S. foreign relations on NGOs, there mm-hmm. tends to be sometimes an overemphasis on the kind of non-governmental part. But as you're very sensitive to the interests of the U.S. government on the one hand, these NGOs right. and other third parties that interact with them, and there are some points, as you just mentioned, when they come together for strategic reasons, it's beneficial, perhaps just for financial reasons, but there are other institutional, there are other overlaps, and then other times they move apart, and so it's constantly changing, and one has to be sensitive to those dynamics. And I think that's done really well throughout the book.
Thanks. And then also don't forget, and this was something I really came across through the archival research, was working hand in glove with U.S. corporations, not all U.S. corporations, different, again, context matters, but you know, many of the earliest proponents for getting Rotary clubs into Latin America are, you know, Waterman Pen Company, who knew, you know, National City Bank, no surprise there, you know. So it's, there are a lot of corporations and a lot of industries, you know, Pacific Mail Steamship Company was crucial in setting up the first clubs in Manila and Yokohama, for example, in Shanghai. And I go into that in the book, actually. So, so again, it's that strategic playing the states. It's at the corner of state and market there, you know, at times specific U.S. corporations, industries, and specific, you know, corporate managers at the highest levels are seeking to work through Rotary clubs, or they're just really devoted Rotarians, right? Who just see themselves as setting up a club in another country in another city because it just makes sense to them. And they do that because, again, they're tapping into pre-existing networks of social and business networks that are already there. That's kind of the thing, is it's not like the U.S. empire is – thing that's just like a big balloon that's increasing over time with more and more air, you know. And I kind of try to tease that out as best I could in the Cuba chapter, is that there are these pre-existing regional and social business networks that were forged during the tail end of the Spanish Empire, and in some ways going back centuries, that the U.S. industrialists and by extension U.S. Rotary clubs are able to tap into and move into. And the Cuban Rotarians are more than happy to reciprocate because they see their own interests possibly being served here as well. You know, this is not there's a lot of quid pro quo and there's a bit of a transactional approach on the part of many sides here, you know? But again, context is everything, right?
Right. I want to get into some of those kind of case studies that you present, but first, I mean, you've given us this great overview of the Rotary's growth and some of the kind of vectors of its growth, and we've been talking about civic internationalism. I want to think a bit about the limitations of the language of civic internationalism and also kind of how it changed over time, and it would be great to perhaps ground these in some examples from the book, but I'm just thinking about, you know, this language of civic internationalism, trying to make capitalism seem sort of less evil, more about helping the community, and you know, service above self mentality. You know, in a lot of places that the U.S. Has interacted with, this probably was hard to convince even local elites who perhaps had a vested interest in participating with groups like the Rotary. They might have had a hard time selling it within the kind of political environments that they were in. So I was just wondering, what are the limitations of this language? Can you think about cases when it doesn't really work? They don't buy it. So it's hard to kind of establish this partnership between the Rotary and other, you know, elites or business people in other nations, and trying to convince local politicians to kind of go along with this.
Sure, I could give you, my head's swelling with, you know, examples right now.
Yeah.
But one that I do cover in the book, for example, is that, you know, the Rotarians in Havana are quite gung-ho about joining, getting their own Rotary Club in 1916. It's the first non-Anglophone Rotary Club, so it's a big to-do for especially the U.S. Rotarians that year. But also it was a kind of culminating moment for the Cubans who are signing on to establish this newfangled civic club called the Rotary Club, right? But within 10 years, by 1926, you know, there's a period of, by the early 1920s, and for anyone who knows anything about, you know, Cuban history, there you can guess this, but there's a period there between 1918, 1919, but especially going into the 1920s, of rather profound disillusionment with not only the U.S. government, but with but with the ups and downs, the severe ups and downs of the sugar market and the sugar prices on during this period, and they tried to work through the U.S. Rotary clubs, which are thousands of clubs at this point by the early 1920s, where they come up with a form letter, and they get permission from the Chicago headquarters to essentially try and make their case, the Havana Rotarians, to these thousands of U.S. Rotary clubs and Canada as well, and the British Empire actually, but especially U.S. clubs. And their belief is that they, this organization can serve in the way that it has effectively kind of claimed to serve, which is a kind of middle ground, a kind of a parliament of businessmen was a phrase from that period that they used. And so they made their case, the form letters went out, et cetera, and they had some success making their case among all these clubs and all their members. But at the end of the day, the senators and congressmen from the sugar producing states of Louisiana, Michigan, Colorado, California, kind of had more influence on the ultimate, tariff policies of the U.S. during that period, and at the severe expense of the Cubans. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of period of rather severe disillusionment experienced by the Cubans already by the early 1920s. And then that just gets worse over time, as you can imagine. So in many ways, the history of the Havana Rotary Club was a kind of microcosm of the Platt Amendment, right? Which is, again, why that chapter is called Under the Shadow of Rotary, and, referencing, Under the Shadow of Platt. So that would be an example, in some ways, of kind of what you're getting at, where, these rather broad, uplifting promises of made through civic internationalism, when push came to shove, when it came to, the ins and outs of U.S. tariff policy going into the 1920s, well, guess what? It failed to have the influence that it promised. There are other examples I give with the Havana Rotarians, but that's probably, I think, one of the most salient at kind of the international level. Another quick example comes to mind is, say, Turkey. They tried very hard through Jim Davidson, who was kind of the, quote, Marco Polo of Rotary between 1928 and 1931. He and his wife and daughter traveled from Prague. They started in Prague and then started with the goal of connecting Rotary clubs between Istanbul and Athens, Alexandria, Cairo, Jerusalem, all the way across through Central Asia, South Asia, into Southeast Asia, and then into East Asia. So the goal was to spend several years setting up these clubs so that there's kind of this unbroken chain of Rotary clubs connecting the world, right? Istanbul was the first place that Jim Davidson goes into this kind of frontier context where there's no Rotary club. They never heard of it. Turkey itself is this newly hatched, modernizing, secularizing society. And it looked like he had it all figured out, and they were going to have a club set up in Ankara. And then lo and behold, it got shot down because this early government, this new government, saw Rotary as, they got confused by the name Rotary International and thought it had something to do with, Communist International. you couldn't be farther from Communist International. But in their minds, it didn't make sense to them what this organization was about. They didn't trust it, and it was deemed a kind of foreign organization. And so Ankara ended up not having, or the first Rotary Club in Turkey ended up being in Ankara in 1955, right? So it's kind of funny and sad at the same time to read how Jim Davidson is speaking one kind of modern business language in his world, and it's not quite resonating and making sense with, these mid-level administrators and, businessmen in what is newly called Istanbul at that point, right?
Right.
So that would be an example of it. But all of chapter 6 is Jim running into very similar scenarios between Cairo, Alexandria, and effectively kind of operating much of that time throughout the British Imperium,
Well, I want to ask, actually, that's That's a really fascinating part. I mean, we were talking earlier about the kind of the way that the Rotary relied upon existing networks. In some cases, those were sort of business networks. Other cases, in this context, they were imperial networks.
That's right.
Could you just talk a little bit about that, how the Rotary was drawing on these existing imperial commercial networks to make it easier to kind of expand and to establish relationships with you know, local business people in Asia or in Cairo.
And I think I might have missed this during my dissertation phase, but it really, when I really went back during kind of the rewrite for the book, is that for the story of Jim and Lillian Davidson setting up these clubs, Jim was setting up the clubs and then Lillian was kind of serializing their travels through Asia, writing back as almost like basically a syndicated columnist about their travels and so forth, and writing in the kind of travelogue mode of the period, like, you know, as if she were writing for National Geographic. And so they ended up kind of serving as de facto cultural ambassadors for Rotary, and he was understood as not simply a U.S. born businessman from Canada traveling through the British Empire. The complex layers of his own history, biography, and identities helped push the notion of him representing this international institution and international business first and foremost. And it was kind of almost ancillary that he happened to have been a U.S. born citizen who then became a Canadian businessman and citizen, right? So as a result, Jim Davidson had a long history and background working as a consular agent in Shanghai for the United States government before these travels, and I go into that in chapter six. But the point is that this was a guy who was well suited for kind of operating within the constant changing flux of the British Empire and British international business connections, which were not the same as the U.S., for example. And so there were ways, and he over time he kind of goes into this. How do I disarm these potential recruits for a Rotary club in, say, you know, Bombay, you know, what's now Mumbai? But how can I present myself as not just an extension of the British Empire, but at the same time, or the U.S., the United States government, but at the same time, familiar with the British Empire? So, you know, the way he would speak and interact with someone who was formally part of the British Empire and its administration would be one way. And then the way he would interact with and speak with and try to recruit, you know, someone who was native to Mumbai, someone who was native to the Federated Malay States, someone who was native to, you know, these different cities and parts of the British Empire. He learned how to speak multiple registers, if that makes sense, especially when it came to international business, in ways that showed awareness of the British Imperium in a kind of respect for it, but at the same time with a realization that what he's doing here is something new and something that doesn't necessarily align with the interests of the British Empire per se. But that said, you know, the first non-U.S. Or not the first British head of Rotary International was Sidney Pascal in the late, 1930, who then travels the world as, you know, the Rotary International's international president. So he's a kind of effectively a diplomat, but at the same time, and he could move through the British Imperium of the of 1930 effectively as if he were a British administrator, but he was moving under the guise of being the head of Rotary International. So he was seen again as this kind of neutral entity, or at least he could be seen a certain way from those who were in direct support of the British Empire, and then also for those who were kind of, you know, chafing against the British Empire and looking for something new, they could they could look at Jim Davidson, they could look at Sidney Pascal, and they could look at the formation of this new local Rotary Club as something that was not beholden to the British Empire in British ways of doing business. Do you see?
Yeah. Well, it's really fascinating to see the cases when Rotarians are able to really successfully adapt to local circumstances, mm-hmm. build on existing imperial networks, right. You know, to ultimately spread the Rotary. But then there are cases, and this is getting back to the civic internationalism bit, where I think there are some certain kind of like hard limits in their ability, I think, to adapt. And I'm thinking specifically of when you're talking about, you know, the book is obviously very focused on race and how that structures some of the mm-hmm. hierarchies within the Rotary. And as you note in the introduction somewhere, that the more vexing racial differences were in any given time and place, the more silent was the Rotary.
Yep.
Could we talk about cases when the kind of racial beliefs of some Rotarians and the racial hierarchy that they kind of had in mind really was counterproductive in some ways to this mission that they had, at least this expressed mission of becoming this great international organization. So kind of where they weren't able to be as flexible as they were in the kind of Jim Davidson cases that you outline. I'm thinking of the Haiti example, but.
Right. Yeah. I figured that's what you're getting at. Right. Yeah. So these were materials I was coming across during the dissertation phase that I was able to kind of indicate and talk about to some degree in the dissertation, but I wasn't, it took some years and some time after the dissertation to kind of do some more archival work and some a little bit more theoretical work to say, okay, this is what's really going on here. Because what I was getting at was what I was seeing more and more in the Haiti example is the most poignant example of it. So that's why I go into it in some detail in chapter two, is the connective tissues of whiteness, for lack of a better term, in the context of international business and transnational cultural exchange, you know? Here you have all these U.S. Rotary clubs holding all these minstrel shows, for example, for decades, right? From the 1910s through, in some cases, up to the 1960s. And they'll hold these minstrel shows to raise money for local community projects, right? And I didn't even include that in my dissertation, for example, because I'd written some seminar papers on it. But I didn't see how I could connect that to the bigger story of, you know, Rotary at the international level. And it wasn't until I started looking at the push for setting up a Rotary club in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, in the early 1920s, when I really started being able to connect the dots between, you know, the Jim Crow realities of U.S. Rotary clubs and those, you know, the rest of the United States and the rest of the U.S. Rotary clubs, either directly or tacitly supporting, the racial boundaries behind that. And it really came out with the sugar company, the Haitian sugar company. I'm blanking on the name right now. Hasco. So you have major corporations looking to set up a Rotary club in Port-au-Prince, and to establish this club in the early 1920, 21, 22. And in doing that, they're trying to bring in, naturally, as they do in almost every other city, is to bring in kind of their what they consider to be the natural business leaders, the most important business leaders of the city/nation, since it's the capital city, right? So they're looking to do in Port-au-Prince in, say, 1920, 21, what they did in Havana in 1916, right? Or Mexico City soon thereafter, or Buenos Aires or Montevideo or wherever. And it looked like it was going to be follow the same route to success and formal establishment of a club and formal acceptance of its charter and so forth. And then they hit a snag with the what at the time was called the Foreign Service or the Foreign Extension Committee. Mm-hmm. And so you had some of the highest levels of Rotary at the time saying, wait a minute, let's step back. Should we have a Rotary Club in Haiti? And then others levels, highest levels of Rotary stepping back at the same time in the same year, saying, should we have a Rotary Club in Tokyo and in Japan? Because, you know, they're not a Christian civilization. We don't think they're ready for this slash us. Right. And so I kind of go into this in chapter two, because Tokyo goes in one direction and gets the charter membership, and Tokyo and Japan becomes a major epicenter for growth for Rotary from 1920 on. Whereas the Port-au-Prince story ends up being a club that's shot down. And I don't think, I forget the exact year, that there's not a Rotary Club in Port-au-Prince until I think 1961 or something. Mm. So what happened here, right? Mm. Why did Tokyo and the Japanese Empire go in one direction and became seen as this kind of, point of celebration and what I call the exotic peers of Rotary International? Look how great Rotary is and how expansive and inclusive this organization is, and how easily and quickly we were able to establish clubs, not just in Tokyo and Yokohama, but throughout the entire Japanese Empire. And then at the same time, within the Caribbean, for example, or for that matter, within Mexico and Latin America, they're drawing the color line, and they're looking to maintain it as best they can. And it's a real set of there's some real tensions and debates within the organization, because you have many others pushing back and saying, you know, we have all these broad claims within our, you know, the way we talk about international peace and cooperation, and yet here we are saying we cannot allow men of African descent into our clubs, because therefore they'd have the right to go into the United States and theoretically go to any club anywhere in the country and rub shoulders, they and their wives, at social events. And that was the real concern, was, you know, the intimacy of bumping into people at these social events, at these conferences, and that was their big concern. It wasn't so much that, you know, oh, the club can stay down there. The fear was that once they become an official member of a club anywhere in the world, they effectively have a kind of passport for going into any club in the world. Hmm. Right. And that was just simply inconceivable for, especially, as you can imagine, Rotarians in the highest levels who were coming, hailing from Jim Crow cities in particular. So this all kind of came out in the post dissertation research phase. And so again, it's trying to kind of identify and draw out, you know, connect the dots of these kind of connective tissues of whiteness, for lack of a better phrase. Mm-hmm. And it's embedded within this notion, I think, or at least I try to make the case that it's embedded within this notion of it's not my idea of racial capitalism, but it's it's a multi-layered form of racial capitalism, right? Because you have U.S. corporations pushing for the inclusion of high-level Haitians in the Rotary Club, and then a pushback from even Canadian and British Rotarians saying, it's great to have a club throughout Latin America, for example, but let's not have them be, they still need to be some version of white in our sense. And then I didn't put this in the book, but you can imagine Mexican Rotarians who go into Texas as, you know, for a conference or an international convention or something, and then they run into Jim Crow laws because their skin's seen as too brown by some hotel manager. Right. And like, what is going on here? And of course, Rotary is not equipped ideologically, institutionally, or any other way. It's not equipped to deal with these concrete points of tension and confrontation. Do you see?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
So the Tokyo story ends up being this kind of grand narrative of the, you know, this, you know, the fact that foreigners are not allowed within the international organization. We are inclusive of these other peoples and nations and races from around the world, and yet right on the doorstep of the United States. And of course, the real touchstone becomes Haiti, where the opposite story takes root and becomes predominant, and that being, you know, again, that, you know, defining and defending these connective tissues of whiteness within international business.
Yeah, I mean, it's really good examples of just when the kind of local and global dimensions of the Rotary are, you know, come into kind of conflict and cause great discomfort and panic amongst Rotarians.
That's right.
I want to get in two more questions before we wrap up, if that's okay.
Sure.
The next question is partially about sources, but you know, you had mentioned when I asked you the first question how you had received a Rotary scholarship early on, and I'm just wondering, you know, first, how do you think this book will be received by Rotarians? I mean, I'd imagine you were thinking about this partially when you're writing it, and I don't know if this is connected to a source issue, but when you were researching during the dissertation and then follow up research when you're working on the monograph, was kind of access to sources partially dependent on, you know, creating your own set of relationship with Rotarians and trying to understand how the organization functioned?
Right. So let's see. What was the first part of your question again? Because my mind was racing for the second.
Yeah. Just like when you were kind of writing the book and working the dissertation, what was your thought on how Rotarians would, because you're quite critical in the book. We were just kind of talking about the racial issues. So what's your kind of expectation, I guess? Have you talked to Rotarians? Have they read it yet?
It's tricky because, and I mentioned this before, Harvard Press wanted me to write a book that was half academic, half trade. And I wanted to write a book that was half academic, half trade, because I think it's important to write scholarship that's accessible to the public as much as possible. So given that, I wanted to keep in mind writing in a way that would be as accessible as possible to Rotarians, but that should mean that I should sugarcoat it for Rotarians, right? I've given many talks to Rotary clubs in the past year, especially on this. And I usually give excerpts from, say, my chapter 6 with the Davidsons going through Asia. Mm. And then I kind of try to make the argument, look, I'm talking about the history of Rotary International within a broader context of U.S. global ascendancy during the first half of the 20th century. And then they kind of get it. But as you can imagine, Rotarians tend to be, you know, they're coming from because of their class, their identity is their class identity in being a basis for their membership in the organization. Hmm. You know, these are usually going to be people that have some kind of education, means, and resources behind them, and so forth. They're usually relatively well traveled, for example, if not very well traveled in many cases, surprisingly so. I know it's not going to be what most of them expect, because most of them, as you can imagine, most of, if not all, formal institutional histories of Rotary are fairly specific to Rotary itself, and they give the history of the organization as if it's almost happening in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And so that's one major hurdle I have to overcome in my talks and during the Q&A, for example. And I'm sure it's going to be a major hurdle that they're not going to get. A lot of them aren't necessarily going to get reading this book, but I've found them to be surprisingly open to a lot of these arguments, especially because a lot of this is something that happened 50s, 100, 110 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And to give credit where credit is due, you know, the Rotary International of 2021 is noticeably different in a lot of ways. And has, you know, has changed for the better, certainly evolved. So I think there might be, I'm hoping that there will be a sense, especially among women who are members of Rotary International, who can step back and fully appreciate, and many non-white members of Rotary International who can step back and fully appreciate what this book is actually seeking to do. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because they've had their own fair share, I'm sure, of dealing with various forms of, you know, of privilege and whiteness or whatever. So I'm hoping that it will resonate. If nothing else, it will lay out where the organization came from and how it was very much embedded within the period of time that it emerged, right? Mm-hmm. And all that that entailed. It emerged out of the context of, you know, the heyday of race and empire in the United States, 1905, right? Mm. So how could it not reflect the exact same racist ideologies and so forth as the period from which it arose? That said, when it comes to sources, I remember one of my dissertation advisors, for example, saying that, you know, it's really rare to be able to tell the history of businessmen and corporations because, you know, number one, either they just don't keep records or if they do, they don't allow you access to those records. Mm. So I was able to get full access to the Rotary Archives because when I first started going there for my dissertation phase, they were quite literally building the archive in anticipation of the 1905 to 2500 year anniversary. Huh. And so I just started going there the year prior for my social science, the SSRC scholarship that I'd gotten to do the research. And I remember asking the archivist at one point, I wanted to look at what they had on the United Nations. And she said, well, I can't give you that. Give me about 3 more months, maybe 4 or 5. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she said, well, we're not up to you yet. And I can give you anything on anything that starts with P and before, but we're going on P to Q to R right now. So talk to me in about 3 to 4 months on anything that starts with U. And I'm like, okay. So, I mean, it's just really like it was some raw stuff. But at the time, I was able to get full access to the archives. But since then, you know, they've, you know, over time started clamping down on the materials and access to the materials and so forth. So I hate to say it and use a phrase, but I guess I was kind of grandfathered in some ways just by chance. But then also some of the most important stuff that, for example, that much of the details on the Haiti story was found through the Library of Congress in the personal papers of John Barrett, who was kind of a central player in the Foreign Extension / Extension Committee of that time period. And so he was retaining a lot of these communications with rather sensitive material that had, for obvious reasons, been purged or lost or whatever by Rotary long, long before, you know, the 21st century. So that required a bit of sleuthing on my part to kind of, because I knew it was out there. I knew it had to be there, but it took me some time to find it, you know, kind of hidden away in the Library of Congress. And there were some other stuff I came across in the National Archives that unfortunately I couldn't really get them into the book because it didn't quite fit the structure of the chapters, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, as it turned out, so most of the sources for this book project are non-state sources, so to speak, Rotary or Rotary adjacent, right? Mm. But every now and then, you know, I would find something, you know, that was made possible through either the National Archives or the Library of Congress or something else. Mm. So in other words, the sources largely reflect the nature of the organization itself. And no shocker there. It's just I kind of got lucky in that I was able to get full access to a lot of these sources before they, just as they were being archived and before they were kind of being then, you know, sequestered, so to speak.
Yeah. As someone who's kind of, you know, doing in the research phase of his dissertation now, I've been thinking a lot about these questions.
And I'm sure
a lot of it's, as you're kind of mentioning, being in the right place at the right time with certain sensitive material. Right. But also, as you mentioned, I mean, you could often find some of the really interesting sources in places you perhaps wouldn't expect and kind of triangulate that way.
And so
encouraging at the same time. I want to end with a question about what you're working on currently, what the next project is. I know book has just been published. Probably want to take a much deserved break, but what are you kind of interested in currently? Are you going to continue to look at organizations like the Rotary? Is the next project going to be quite different from that?
Well, actually, one of the projects I was thinking of for several years was the Peace Corps. and for a whole bunch of reasons. So, and probably the main reason is that, I guess it was 4 years ago, the Return Peace Corps volunteers in this part of Florida asked me to give a talk at a fundraiser they were having. And it came up in a phone conversation with kind of the person organizing that event that I mentioned that back in the 90s, I interned for about 5-6 months with Harris Wofford, who was in the U.S. Senate for in the early 90s. And Harris Wofford was kind of a liaison between the Kennedy administration and the civil rights movement. He was, kind of present at the creation in many ways, or at the height of post-war liberalism, right? And the Peace Corps was his idea, not really Sergeant Shriver's. And so what I did was I just gave a talk about kind of the backstory to the official story of the origins of the Peace Corps. And then I gave that talk to this organization and they thought, wow, we had no idea. Mm. And I thought, well, I guess they don't. What are the odds that I happen to have interned in Senator Wofford's office and got to know the guy a little bit and, you know, became aware of and had some, at the time were just informal conversations with him about the origins of the Peace Corps. So it got me thinking about, again, it's kind of like I'm taking the template from the RI perspective on things of like, yes, the Peace Corps is a state agency, obviously, and kind of a classic expression of modernization goals and modernization theory put into practice, so to speak. But when I actually looked at the in the past year, especially when I started looking at, what's really been published on the history of the Peace Corps, for example, a lot of it is kind of a little bit like what you would see with Rotary and a lot of other institutions where they focus on the history of the institution itself. And it almost as if it's an independent variable from the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, no, I don't think it works that way. So, so that's kind of what I'm looking at is an institution like that, an organization like that. And then kind of looking at it through the lens of the heyday of post-war liberalism, the heyday of modernization theories put into practice and so forth. So that's, I would love to be able to pursue that project, but I'm just kind of revving up my, my engines for something like that.
Right. Well, great. That sounds really fascinating. I'll look forward to reading, whatever, when it materializes into an article or book. But just thanks again for agreeing to talk today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, likewise.
All right. Take care then.
Thank you, Stephen. You have a good day.